And everybody else, maybe they'll be listening to this later on, getting the downloads. And so now you can feel shame if you're not here. Shame. All of you listening on your iPod, shame. Okay. Well, let's pray and we'll begin. Holy Father, again, we come to you and asking that you would be present with us for the sake of your gospel and your glory, that we would be prepared to bring your gospel to the world. Sometimes a simple proclamation is necessary, and sometimes we have to do a lot of work to remove some of these barriers to belief. And so strengthen us to do that. Teach us, O Lord, and beyond our teaching, give us hearts that earnestly desire to take every opportunity to move your kingdom forward as unbelief is conquered by the blood of the Lamb. Please make that our task today, we ask in Christ's name. Amen. Okay, so we're back on apologetics, and this is going to be our first lesson in what we call presuppositional apologetics. Now, as we mentioned at the beginning of the class, I'm looking to Tim Keller's The Reasons for God as a resource. We're not doing pure Vantillian presuppositional apologetics. Ooh, I got to make sure I'm exactly philosophically right. This is a lot more feet on the ground presuppositional apologetics. If you're in a debate with a philosopher and you want the most pure and philosophically unassailable position, look to Van Til. He's your guy. If you're actually looking to have a conversation with someone and have them actually come to know the Lord, Van Til is probably not your guy. You want to take what Van Til is teaching and slush it around in your brain and then move it forward. So the philosophy is right, the idea is right, the presentation can be a little cold. But what Keller does, I think, following John Frame and some others, is he takes the presuppositional ideas of Van Til and moves them into a real-world setting. Essentially, what we're trying to do, and the way that I'd rather just kind of do it than have a long conversation about what it is, but let me just encapsulate it like this. What we're trying to do in this realm of apologetics is we're trying to engage with an unbeliever who has doubts about the Christian faith and say to them, have you ever considered doubting your doubts? The things that you hold to be true, what happens if you doubt those and not just Christianity? And what happens if you doubt your doubts about Christianity? You say, well, that couldn't be true about the Bible. Well, you're encouraging me to doubt my faith. Can I encourage you to doubt your faith? And so we're looking to unearth where faith is found. Where do we actually see unbelievers exhibiting faith? Everybody is exhibiting faith at some level. They say, I don't think there are any values. I'm a complete nihilist. But even then, they're believing in their own ability to assess what is true. So, for example, say somebody's they say, no, I don't even believe in human rights. Those are religious beliefs. I've sworn those off. I simply believe in pure, unadulterated reason. I say, so where do you think humans came from? Well, we evolved. I support evolutionary theory and all that. But evolutionary theory does not tell you that people who have truth survive and reproduce. Evolutionary theory says the people who survive and reproduce are the people who are best able to survive and reproduce. And so your brain, according to evolutionary theory, is not there so that it will help you tell what is true or not true. It only tells you what is true insofar as what is true helps you to survive and reproduce. Your brain is made to keep your brain going until you have children and raise those children to an age at which they can protect themselves. That's it. So if for example, you think that nighttime is a time of great danger, it doesn't matter if it's true. That helps you survive. It may be that daytime is actually a time of greater danger, but for our evolutionary ancestors, for them, night was more dangerous, and so we have a natural fear of the night, because that's when predators were out. Now we're far more in danger of being killed by a car than a carnivore. I just made that up, by the way. Car, carnivore, tip of my mind. Brilliance. In action. No. So you're scared at night, but really you should be scared on the road. So evolutionary theory then is not presenting you with the brain that is helping. Your brain doesn't even have the ability to discern truth. It only has the ability to keep you alive. So maybe all of your beliefs about the world are wrong. They're just there to help you survive. So, should believers have doubts? Is it healthy for believers to have doubts? What are your thoughts on this? Okay, whether it's healthy or not, you will have them. You will have doubts in your Christian faith. So if that's, does everybody agree with that? I'm seeing the elders nod their heads yes, so that's probably pretty good, yeah. I think that's true. And this might be encouraging to you kids as well. You're growing up, you're not faced with a whole lot of people challenging your faith at this stage in your life, especially at like your age, and Muffy, your age, and Rebecca, your age. So at some point in your life, you will probably experience some kind of doubt. And kids, I'm going to ask you, you can look around at your parents. We don't have a ton of people here today. But kids, look around. Adults, I want you to raise your hand if you've ever doubted anything about the Bible or the Christian faith. So kids, look around. That's some of you kids, but I think all of the adults here have raised their hand. And I'm going to tell you that living in a fallen world, we do have doubt, and it's healthy to be able to express those doubts and to discuss those, because number one, we have good answers, I think, for every doubt I've ever heard anybody ever having. And so we're going to be able to guide you through that into truth. And number two, you're going to be able to understand the sorts of things that unbelievers themselves would doubt. So when they say, it doesn't make sense to me that there could be a resurrection, or it doesn't make sense to me that God could really be good despite the fact that bad things happen, then you can say, well, you know, I've had a touch of that myself. I know what that's like. And probably you will recognize, like, if something bad has happened to a friend, and it's happened to you too, like if their favorite pet dies, and you've never had a pet, you're like, well, that's too bad. But if their pet dies and you had a pet that you really loved and your pet also died, then you remember, you're like, oh, I remember what that was like. Yeah, boy, that's sad. I really feel for you. And you're able to comfort them in a way that you wouldn't be able to. So we will have doubt, and it's okay to express your doubt, because that's how we deal with doubt. So unbelievers too. So here's something that we share with unbelievers, that we have doubts of the Christian faith. Now, they have a lot more and a lot more extensive, but we might not have a whole lot of them at one particular point in time, but throughout the course of your life, you will. And so unbelievers, if we can find it, nevertheless have a strong belief of their own. And so we actually want to help move them into doubt of their beliefs. So let me give you a couple phrases, and you tell me, when I make the phrase, you tell me what the unbeliever's faith is. Tell me where they're putting their faith, okay? An unbeliever says, everyone should determine truth for him or herself. Everyone should determine truth for him or herself. Where's the faith in that statement? Go ahead. Okay, the faith in everyone. What do you mean? Okay, they're assuming that everyone has the ability to discern truth, that they have the autonomy, that they're going to be good at finding out what is true. Somebody says, well, yeah, I determined truth for myself, and then I joined ISIS. You're like, no, this is not good. What if somebody says people have the right to choose their own religion? What's being assumed there? People have the right to choose their own religion. First of all, in America anyway, that's a true statement in a particular sense, right? It's legally true. Go ahead, Lexi. That's right. They might be assuming that everyone has the right to choose their own religion according to God because, hey, all religions are the same thing. Yeah, in fact, you would have to be saying that, wouldn't you? You could not be saying, well, there is one religion that's right and all the others are wrong, or you couldn't say Western Abrahamic religions are right and Eastern religions are wrong, and also say people have the right, in a divine sense, to choose their own religion. Again, of course, we recognize that in this country at this time, everyone can choose their own religion legally. What about this? You know, I think your discussion about religion it's unimportant. I believe in God, and God just wants you to be a good person. Where's the faith of that? If somebody says, God just wants you to be a good person, what's the nature of God?
Moralistic therapeutic deism.
Yeah, he's moralistic therapeutic deism. In that scenario, God just wants you to be a good person. God has pretty low standards, pretty ill-defined standards. Good is pretty relative. He wants you to be good. And so this opens up a whole new set of questions. Why does God want you to be good? Why does it bother him if you're bad? How good do you have to be? What if I'm not very good? What if I wasn't good for 30 years and then I started being good for 10 years? If I'm 3 times as good for those 10 years as I was bad for those 30 years, does that even out? What's the algebra here? What's that? And who defines good in the first place? What is good? Well, good like God says. Okay, well, what does he say? By all means, and where can we read about this? Okay. So today we're going to be looking at the particular claim that there can't be just one religion. There can't be just one religion. And so if somebody says, well, listen, you're a Christian, you're trying to tell me you want me to be a Christian, that's really nice and all, but I just don't think there could be one religion that is true while all the others are not true. One of the things we'd want to correct about that probably immediately is that we're not claiming that Presbyterian, parenthesis PCA, close parenthesis, is the one true religion. Right? I got a couple people saying, what? Wait a second. So we would affirm that the Orthodox Presbyterian Church and the Bible Presbyterian Church, a number of Presbyterian churches, probably have no less truth than we do. And we would also affirm that there's a number of non-Presbyterian Christian churches that are also quite true, that we differ in some small things. But, you know, if I drive a Ford and I say American cars are the best, that doesn't mean that because I drive a Ford, I hate all Chevys and all Chevys are bad, or because I drive a Ford Focus that every other Ford is bad. So we would say, first of all, that we're making the case that biblical Christianity is true and that that is best expressed in the Reformed faith, but also very well expressed in what we would call evangelical Protestantism, and to a lesser extent, but still at some level true, with all of Christianity. So we have grave differences between, say, Orthodox and Roman Catholics, but at least a Roman Catholic is talking about the triune God. So we could say, well, we do have that in common. When we're talking about the one God in three persons, us and a Roman Catholic, we're talking about the exact same person. Contrary to like a Jehovah's Witness or a Unitarian, we don't recognize them as Christians or have any sense of fellowship. So in any case, the person comes and they say, look, there can't be just one religion. The exclusive claims are limiting and they're untrue. And there's all kinds of conflict that comes out of asserting that there's just one religion. And, you know, and look, we're having a conflict now. And all around the world there are conflicts between people and even groups because they're Sunni and Shia, whatever it might be, because they're asserting that there's just one religion. So that's the problem. What we must do is we must not assert that there is one religion only, says the unbeliever. And so, let's say they take that position. So you can ask them, okay, so you want to say there can't just be one religion, so how do you want to approach that? How would you work that out? This belief that there can't just be one religion. There's three main categories that would fall under. The first would be to outlaw religion. To say we're outlawing specific, you can hold a general belief, or it's being entirely outlawed. This is happening in places around the world, of course. That we're going to condemn religion as something outdated and something inappropriate for modern society. Or we're going to radically privatize religion, which is to say, and you might recognize this from recent legal wranglings, you can believe whatever you want to, you just can't let it affect your life, work, business, or values. It can have no effect on your life, but you can go to church and believe whatever you want. And that's probably the most popular approach these days, is when you're in the public, you have to behave as a public person and a civic person along the lines which we will define for you. But when you go to your place of worship, you can handle snakes or do whatever you want. And who brought the snakes today? Mac, did you? Thank you. Good. We'll see who, true believers and not. No, just kidding. Okay, so outlawing religion. To outlaw religion, well, first of all, secular attempts to outlaw religion have always failed in the long term. They might have temporary, limited success, but they never seem to last. So the USSR had essentially outlawed religion. The Russian Orthodox Church was allowed to exist as a bare, hollow shell, but the state religion was atheism. Couldn't believe anything. And, of course, that didn't stand. It never does. In communist China right now, the gospel is taking off. It's you know, converts, thousands of converts every day to the Christian faith in China. Furthermore, you couldn't outlaw it because it's simply not going to happen. It's growing so fast around the world already. Do you know, there are more in Ghana, the nation of Ghana, there are more Presbyterians than there are in the United States and Scotland combined. And those numbers, there are more Anglicans in Nigeria than there are in England. And that's just on the rolls, particularly when you're considering the number of people who actually believe it and actually attend worship. And so in Nigeria, you have Anglicans, that's what we in America call Episcopalians for reasons well beyond me, but in Anglicans in Nigeria actually believe the Bible. They trust in God. They look to Him for their salvation. They worship Him because God is a real real entity, and they believe that God loves them and knows them. Good luck even finding that in the Anglican Church of England. It's weak. It's anemic. It's pathetic. They've had periodically an Archbishop of Canterbury who seems to have some kind of belief, but they have bishops and archbishops all over the place who have nothing that is recognizable as the Christian faith as it has been practiced for 2,000 years, or even for the first 1,800 years of the Christian faith, from 100 AD to 1900 AD, they believe things that no Christian ever would have called Christianity. As the gospel grows in China, at some point China will have half a billion Christians. That's a greater number than the population of the United States. That's going to change church history forever. And when historians look back on this era, 2,000 or 3,000 years from now, they're going to look back and at least 1,000 years from now, right? they're going to look back and they're going to see this is the era in which Christianity made a tremendous shift from the Western, predominantly white world to the Southern Hemisphere, to Africa and to China, to Asia. It's not, we talk about the church being in Jerusalem, and then kind of the center of Christianity became Rome, and then the center of Christianity kind of became England and the Americas, as we were the ones sending out missionaries and really delivering the faith that we would recognize as the Christian faith. That's going to change. And people are going to look at the dominance of the United States and the missionary sending world as a relic, just like we say, oh, and also the church used to be headquartered in Jerusalem. Very interesting. It's certainly not anymore. And your systematic theologies are not going to be written in English and translated into Chinese. They're going to be written in Chinese. And Americans are going to be, if we don't speak Chinese at that point, we're going to be clamoring for the latest translation, so we can see what the most important theologians of the day are writing about. So outlawing religion simply will not work. So the second thing you can do is you can condemn religion. And to condemn religion, you're simply trying to subvert the beliefs. You're teaching that all religions are equally valid, and they teach the same thing. This is one way to subvert belief and to say, how do we take value out of somebody's religious beliefs? Well, we try to subvert it. So we say, well, all your religions, they're all the same. They all teach the same thing, which is just another way of condemning that. Now, what's the hidden belief there? If we say all religions are equally valid and teach the same thing, what's the hidden assumption that they have? Okay, yeah, they would say perhaps if there is a heaven, everyone goes there, that there's no judgment, or maybe that judgment is based on a particular thing. Dave, go ahead. Yeah, if they're all equally valid, then they're all lying. Is there one God or multiple gods? Is God a uncreated creator, or is he himself created by his father, Kronos? Which one is it? We need a choice. And you get to this point where, only a postmodern deconstructionist could make any sense of this. if words carry meaning, like if words don't carry meaning, then let's not have this conversation because you just gave me a recipe for how to make a hot dog. No, I didn't. I told you about religion. No, that was a hot dog recipe because words don't have meaning. But if words do have meaning, then we cannot simultaneously say Jesus is the risen Messiah of the Jews, and he is also at the same time, in an equal sense, not the risen Messiah of the Jews. As long as we're holding on to some semblance of logic and communication, those things simply don't work. An interesting approach to apologetics is to see what people believe already and to show them how much you say, so you believe in God? Yes. Okay, well, you're not a Buddhist already. We're off to a good start. And particularly, you know, people who kind of believe in the moralistic therapeutic deist God of American culture, like when the president says, and God bless America, he doesn't mean the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ bless America, he just means God general. But you can kind of show them how much of what they believe has actually been created and shaped by Christianity, and then how inconsistent they are for accepting 80% of Christianity, but not the whole thing. So again, in a similar way, somebody says, remember the elephant? Do you guys remember the elephant illustration? The elephant and the blind men, the elephant comes in, they say, okay, blind men, in this room is an elephant. Tell us what an elephant is like. And the one feels the leg, and he says, an elephant is like a tree. And the other feels the side and says, no, an elephant is like a wall. And the other says, feels the trunk. He says, no, the elephant is like a snake. And, you know, one feels the tusk and says it's like a spear, and one feels the tail and says, no, it's like a donkey, and et cetera, et cetera. The guy with the trunk gets the water and says, no, an elephant's like a fire hose, and sprays the other guys. Where's the hidden pride and the hidden assumption in that assertion? That all religions see a piece of the truth, but not the whole truth. Well, I guess it does assume the elephant can't speak, right? Yeah, no, it's an assumption that God hasn't spoken, or that he's speaking in a multiplicity of ways, which are inconsistent if language carries meaning. What else are they assuming? Yeah, they're assuming that we all know what an elephant looks like. And so they're saying, listen. You silly religious people, you've been at this for how many thousands of years, but don't worry, I've got it figured out. You all just see a part of the whole, but I see the whole. I've got the whole picture. And let me tell you about it. It's incredibly demeaning, isn't it? It's like you're not even religious, but yet you have this boldly assertive claim that there is actually one great super divine force power thing up here, and you know this. How do you know this? How do you know that this big truth is up here and just conveying these little truths? This little, I'll give a little bit to the Christians, a little bit to the Muslims. Okay, so God is three persons. No, to the Muslims, no, he's just one person. To the Buddhists, no, he's not a person at all. There is no God. To the Taoists, it's the way. Yeah, they're claiming, I see this big super truth, and none of you ignorant fools can see it. It's incredibly arrogant, because they're not even saying, well, you know, at least you can have a little bit of respect for somebody who's Baha'i, who says, well, you know, our prophet has told us about this, and the great God Baha'u'llah is really this super God. At least they have asserted this based on some kind of source. Let's give a little bit of respect for that at the very least. But most of the people are going to talk to, I'm like, so how do you know this? Is this your religion? Are you Baha'i? They're like, no. It just seems to be true to me. So all these years of spiritual people writing and thinking and praying, and you're just like a dude who got it figured out in Starbucks. Good work, man. What if somebody says, and I think we've talked about this one also, religion is too culturally bound and historically bound to actually be true? we are socially conditioned to believe. Somebody says, Mr. DeRoche, you know, as a matter of fact, you grew up in a Christian household, didn't you? And you don't know which one I'm talking to, huh? I was talking to Titus, actually. You grew up in a Christian house. Your dad's a Christian, right? That's right. So is your mom, right? Excellent. Now, does Titus and do his father and his uncle simply believe because they grew up in a Christian house? We could say, well, in a sense, no. In a sense, yes. But let's grant that. Let's say, okay, that's true. I'm a Christian because of my culture. I'm a product of my culture. I'm not a Christian house, but a product of Western evangelical culture. Okay, granted. Now, what about you? You're saying that my belief is therefore invalid because I have grown up in a culture that produced it? But you also, my friend, as you're talking to them, you also grew up in a culture, and your culture produced your belief, did it not? Well, no, I investigated mine. Oh, all right, so I didn't investigate mine, is that it? That's what this is called, it's called the self-accepting fallacy. The self-accepting fallacy. That means a fallacy is a false argument. So that means they're putting forth an argument that applies to everybody but me. So all of you, you're all the product of your culture. But me, I'm an independent genius thinker. I'm not the product of my culture. Well, how do you know that I'm the product of my culture and not an independent thinker? Well, because you don't agree with me. Isn't that obvious? It's once you see it for what it is, it's worth laughing at, and that's about it. The same thing would be true. Somebody says, it's arrogant to insist that your religion is right. Philosopher John Hick wrote, once you realize that there are other intelligent and good people who hold to different beliefs, it is arrogant to try to convert them or to hold your own view as superior. So how would you maybe respond to Dr. Hick here? Once you realize there are other intelligent and good people who hold to different beliefs, it is arrogant to try to convert them or to hold your own view as superior.
Why are you telling me this unless you want to convert me to your position?
That's exactly right, Brian. So you're telling me you hold your view as a superior view to mine? Well, it's not religious. What did you say, Brian? Well, it's not a religious view. This is something else. I'm not talking about your religion.
It's either a worldview statement or it's a philosophical statement, and then I'll just move all views into a philosophical statement.
That's right. It's the definition of a religious view is not at all clear. It is, if you can say, oh, that's a Christian view, or that's a Buddhist view, but what is religion really? And when you get down to it, religion is a belief system which hinges on something that is itself unproven. There's an axiom at the center of it, right? But that's true for everybody. Everybody has an unproven axiom. People say, I just think that people should treat one another with respect. Okay, why do you think that? When you get down to it, people are going to say, because people are worthy of respect, or I'm worthy of respect, and I want to create a culture in which I'll be treated with respect. Yes, but why? There's nothing in an evolutionary worldview that demands respect. You think, you know, one chimpanzee tribe is attacking the other one, and the first tribe says, hey man, you guys, we got to knock this off. Don't you know these chimpanzees are worthy of respect? Where's that? It's not a tragedy when an orca eats a seal. Right? Hey, seals are worthy of respect. No. Just people are. They're more advanced. Okay, more advanced according to whom? The people? Come on. Well, we investigated ourselves and we're the best. Trust me. The attempt to, at the bottom, and if you can ask the right kind of questions, you can get to the bottom where you see that everybody has a worldview, and that worldview hinges on an often unspoken belief. And so then the question becomes, why is your belief superior to mine? Well, it's not. Well, then I'll see you in church on Sunday. We wouldn't be having this debate if you thought it wasn't. So you can't outlaw religion. You can't condemn it. And that same argument, that last one, would apply to this third point, to privatize religion. And this is going to be the one that you're going to encounter. Look, you can believe whatever you want when you go to church, but when you go to the bakery or when you go to the courthouse or when you show up, you've got to obey the civic contract. You've got to, we have a societal, a community agreement that we're going to be truthful people. So you have to obey those civil standards. I say, okay, first of all, where did those civil standards come from and why do I have to obey them? You say to them, are my children obligated to be Christians because I am? And they would say, well, no. Say, well, because I'm a child of the United States, why should I have to obey its laws? Well, because it works. It's what keeps us all at peace with one another. Okay, but what's the value statement? They snuck in a value statement. I just want to be at peace with one another. Go ahead, Dan. Yeah, peace. I hate the word, as I hate hell, all Montague, and thee. Tybalt doesn't like peace. Why am I obligated to want to have peace with you? Maybe I like a fractious society. Maybe I invest in extreme news companies, and the like most extreme right and most extreme left. I invest in them. A fractious society is really good for my stock portfolio. I don't want peace. I want conflict. Maybe I like conflict. You ever meet people and they just like to argue? So, yeah, first of all, why do I want peace? So there again, you have religious values. And secondly, why should I be forced to leave an essential part of my personhood out of a public policy debate? Whereas you get to bring yours. Why am I not allowed to say, these are things that are true and precious and dear to me, and I want them to be part of our discussion? And you say, no, 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 you can't have that. You have to take my values, and with my values, then you have to argue the debate. Well, this doesn't really make a lot of sense, does it? If I had your values, we wouldn't have a debate. So what you're doing is you're saying that inherently my religious values are superior to your religious values, and you're not allowed to discuss yours. We have made that private. So, yeah, I don't think that gay marriage is appropriate. That's not really rightly considered marriage when you have two men getting married. Marriage is an institution that is not sterile. There are some couples, of course, who don't or can't have children, and they're still married. But as an institution, take a bunch of married people together, and they create life. Take a bunch of gay married people together, and they don't create life. I think one of my values is that children should be raised by men and women. Children should have a father and they should have a mother. And this is the best way for them to adapt and to live in a society filled with men and women. And I further think that the gender that you're born with is in fact, your gender. I don't think gender is fluid. I don't think you can change it. And I think that if you desire to change it, it's very sad and you have some kind of a mental illness, and that should be treated accordingly. Not celebrated and put on the cover of magazines. Those are my values. Now, why do I have to leave those back?
They're discriminatory.
is they're discriminatory. Okay, and why is that? You're discriminating against me, you say. Right. So how can you discriminate against me, but I can't discriminate? And furthermore, and let's push this once more, in trying to hold out the Christian faith, we talk about the hope of the gospel itself. Okay, so let's kind of bring this home. Remember, we start off by saying, well, the problem is that religion causes conflict. And that's true. And everybody has a religion, so we're going to live in a world of conflict. But let me ask you, what religion then provides a basis for respectful and dignified conflict with people who are radically different than you? Not Islam. Go ahead. All right. What's the difference between presuppositional and classical? Well, I think that the pure case classical, as the rubber has hit the road with both cases, they've kind of bled into one another to a certain degree, but the. In fact, our values discussion in classical apologetics is, I think, more presuppositional than, I think there's a lot of borrowing there. So again, I don't know that I could give you if John Frame couldn't do it for you, I'm probably not going to do it. I can call John real quick, but.
Mm-hmm. In the beginning, God, all else is chaos, a borrowing of a term or something.
Yeah.
And my understanding and you can use all this in both systems,
mm-hmm.
is I'm coming to the person with a self-conscious, radical, and militant, and evangelistic presupposition.
Right. I think you're talking about approach, and I don't think that presuppositional or classical necessitates a particular approach. Now, the way that you might read a presuppositional, so the question is, what's the difference between the two? And I'm not going to be able to give you a perfectly academic approach, but the way, when I think about the goals of the two, and I, of course, in a conversation, I don't say, okay, now it's a presuppositional conversation, now it's classical. I'm moving from one to the other very quickly. But the way to think about it is presuppositional is saying, I'm trying to find out what you believe and undermine it and destroy your own worldview, which I know I can do because it's not a biblical worldview. So therefore, it can't hold together. It doesn't matter how smart you seem to be. You cannot bring truth because you don't know what it is. And I do, so I know that you're standing on sand and I'm on rock. So that's presuppositionalism. The assumption is, I think from a more kind of pure, if we could call that presuppositional approach, is that I know this person is wrong and I know they have no ability to cognate the fact that they're wrong. So I'm going to try to show them how their worldview doesn't work and how a biblical worldview does. On the other hand, classical apologetics says, okay, there's one thing that a non-believer can do that we all share. It's reason and logic. So come, let us reason together, and I will demonstrate to you that if you simply logically think about this, you will recognize that first there must be a God who is eternal. There must be a God who is a creator. There must be a God who is moral. And that God, the only options we have for world religions are the Western Abrahamic religions. And let me show you how the Old Testament is reliable. Let me show you how the New Testament is reliable and how Christ rose from the dead. So you're assuming on their logic, and it doesn't matter. Presuppositional is, which one of the reasons I really like it as it hits the road, as we're talking about here, is that presuppositional over here is a good conversational apologetic because you're having, you have to find out what they think. So you're asking a lot of questions, and that draws people in. Classical apologetics, you can do your whole presentation and to a crowd, and they know nothing at all. And so you don't know anything about them. And you can do your whole case, boom, case closed, and they haven't said anything. So if, you know, if Dr. Frame frustrates you, I'm sure that you're, this is even worse, but hopefully that gives you a little bit of sense. So let me bring it back, the hope of the gospel as it relates to this. Of course, it's within Christianity that we have the only option available to be able to respect others. We have the only option available to show tremendous grace and patience with those who are radically different than we are. And how can we do that? Well, because God, we are radically, we're made in God's image, but we are nonetheless very different from God, right? We share none of God's incommunicable attributes. And yet God in his mercy sent his Son, who condescended to be down here on our level, to be like us, so that even though we're limited in these human bodies, limited by our human minds, he accommodated our weakness and continues to be patient with us. Furthermore, I would say it's a Calvinist who has the utmost ability, because unlike an Arminian, we don't say, listen, at some level, I was good, I was smarter, I was better, I was more humble, I recognized my sin more than this other guy. We simply say, God showed me mercy when I didn't deserve it. Therefore, I have no reason to be proud about my belief. And if somebody else is a lifelong committed atheist or a lifelong committed Hindu, what do they lack that I have? They don't lack intelligence. They don't lack skill. They don't lack an outward morality. There are lots of unbelievers who can spend a lot more time doing a lot less self-centered things. Right, look at these unbelievers that are like, oh yeah, I dedicated my whole life to creating this homeless shelter and helping, you know, abused puppy dogs and whatever else. Okay, true, we can acknowledge that. But the fundamental difference between me and an unbeliever is that God has shown me mercy when I didn't deserve it and I didn't ask for it. So when we look at that unbeliever, no matter how bad they are, how vile they are in their character, or how terrible they are, or aggressive they are in their unbelief, at the end of the day, at the most base level, they are like that because God has not acted in their lives in the way that God has acted in my life, full stop. That's it. God has been good to me, and he hasn't yet been good to this person, but I pray that he will. Any questions on this? You know, it's once again, it's like, oh, I'm thirsty. Here's a fire hose. Here's an elephant trunk. Have a drink. I have a gross story I'll tell some of the boys later on about an elephant, but not now. We're being recorded. Go ahead, Sandy. Yeah, what determines what's a blessing and what's not? What does it mean to say God has blessed this? Or a lot of times people say, oh, well, you know, great grandma died. Well, she's in a better place. This, you know, maybe the funeral isn't the right place to talk about that, but it's at some point you're able to come back to that and say, No, why, tell me why you say that. What makes you think that she's in a better place? And you're able to talk about that. Okay, well, let's, what have I got for paper here? I don't have paper, but I do have the computer here, oddly enough, so I'm just going to type this right in. Some prayer requests that we can take today.